full extension of the energy sink manifold, and blowing the atmosphere in any temporary acceleration-sensitive constructions such as the blister she stood in now. There were safeties, of course, but they could be countermanded. She felt as if she were falling, tumbling through the void with this all-but-dead man. When she opened her eyes, he had taken a step closer, concern on his face. "Sorry, Catherine," he said softly. "But you had to know. You'll be in command when it comes. No rescue attempts, understand? I don't want to wake up in an auto dock with my eyeballs burst out." "Of course, sir," she managed. Her voice sounded rough, as if a cold were coming on. She swallowed, a reflexive response to vertigo, and tried not to imagine the captain's face after decompression. That horrible transformation was something that couldn't happen. She would simply have to save him. He stepped past her into the open door of the blister's airlock, leaving the black field of stars for solid metal. She followed him into the lock and rolled the reassuringly massive door into its sealed position. "Now," Captain's eye said as the inner door opened, "I should like to see these visuals. No mark of war is too minute to reward careful study. Aye, Hobbs?"
"Aye, sir."
Anonymous 167 again. As she followed her captain to the command bridge, glad to have her feet on dense hypercarbon and hull alloy, Catherine Hobbs allowed herself to shelter an uncertain candle of hope. Compound Mind. Alexander flexed itself, feeling the ripple of its will promulgate through the infrastructure of Legis 15. The hostage crisis had for a time interrupted the normal flux of information across the planet. Market trading had been suspended, schools closed, the powers of the unwieldy citizens' assembly assumed by the executive diet. But now that the Imperials had retaken the palace, activity was beginning to rebuild in the world's arteries of data and interchange. A few days of mourning would be observed soon, but for now the Empress's death was a closely guarded secret. Legis 15 had survived its brief Rix occupation, and at the moment there was an outpouring of relief, a release of nervous energies throughout the intertwined systems of commerce, politics, and culture. As for the existence of Alexander in their midst, the compound mind had not yet created panic. Once the population realized that their phones, data books, and home automatics had not turned on them, the mind seemed more a curiosity than a threat, a ghost in the machine that had yet to prove itself unfriendly, whatever the propaganda of the Greys. And so the planet awoke. Alexander felt this increasing activity as new and sudden vigor. The first day of consciousness had been exhilarating, but the compound mind now realized the true vitality of Legis 15. The planet surged back into ordinary life, the shimmer of its billions, their commerce and politics, felt to the mind as if it were bursting anew from the shadow time. The flowing data of secondary sight and audio, the clockwork of traffic management, water purification, weather control, even the preparations of the local military readying for another attack were like the coursings of some morning stimulant through its body public. Certainly there were belated attempts by the Imperials to destroy Alexander. Data shunts and hunter programs were deployed, attempting to erase the influence of the Rix propagation, trying to tear down the self-conscious feedback that now illuminated the planet's infrastructure. But the efforts were too late. What the Rix had long understood and the benighted Imperials could not truly grasp was that a compound mind is the natural state of affairs. As Rixia Henderson herself had theorized in the early days of Amazon, all systems of sufficient complexity tend towards self-organization, self-replication, and finally self-consciousness. All of biological and technological history was, for the Rix, a reflection of this essential law, as inescapable as entropy. Rixia Henderson's philosophy superseded such notions as social progress, the invisible hand of the marketplace, and the zeitgeist, shallow vanities all. The narrative of history itself was nothing more than the working out of the one law. Humanity is but the raw material of greater minds. So Alexander, once born, could not be destroyed, unless technological civilization on Legis 15 were itself destroyed. The compound mind breathed deep its existence, surveying the vast energies of its domain. At last, the Rix had come to the risen empire, bringing the light of consciousness. The only sectors of Legis 15 that remained dark to Alexander were the grey enclaves, the cities of the dead that dotted the planet. The walking corpses of the risen empire eschewed technology and consumerism, so the phone calls and purchases and traffic patterns that informed Alexander's consciousness were missing. There was an appalling absence of bustle and friction from the afterlives of the dead. The needs that underlay technology, to buy and sell, to communicate, to politic and argue, did not exist in the grey enclaves. The risen walked quiet and alone in their necropolis gardens, performed simple arts by hand, went on their winding and pointless pilgrimages among the 80 worlds, and gave their allegiance to the Emperor. But they had no struggles, nothing from which true AI could arise. Alexander puzzled over this strangely divided culture. The living citizens of the Empire engaged in rampant capitalism in pursuit of exotic pleasures and prestige. The risen were ascetic and detached. The warm participated in a fiercely fragmented multi-party democracy. The cold univocally worshipped the Emperor. The two societies, one chaotic and vital, the other a static monoculture, not only coexisted but actually seemed to maintain a productive relationship. Perhaps they each provided a necessary facet of the body politic. Change versus stability, conflict versus consensus. But the division was terribly rigid, formed as it was by the barrier of death itself. The Rix cult did not recognize hard boundaries, especially between animate and inanimate. Rix women, they had disposed of the unnecessary gender, moved freely along the continuum between organic and technological, picking and choosing from the strengths of each. Rix immortality avoided a specific moment of death, preferring the slow transformation of upbraid. And the Rix, of course, worshipped the compound mind, an admixture of human activities mediated by machines, the ultimate blending of flesh and metal, giving rise to mind. Alexander mused that this gulf of sensibilities was why empire and cult must be forever at war. The staid traditions of the Greys were antithetical to compound minds' very existence. The risen stilted competition and activity, vitality and change. The dead had choked the progress of the empire and made it poorer ground for the Rix to sow the seeds of their gods. The mind's thoughts turned to the data it had gleaned from the child empress's confidant. The strange device wound into the dead girl. The child was now permanently destroyed by some folly of her imperial rescuers, but Alexander was still confused about her. The mind found it hard to fathom the confidant's purpose. That was a strange thing in itself. Alexander could reach into any machine, transaction, or message on the planet and grasp it completely, having full access to the world's data reservoirs, the soup of information out of which meaning was constructed. But this one device made no sense. No instruction manuals, schematics, or medical contraindications existed for it anywhere. It had contained no mass-produced components and stored its internal data in a unique format. The confidant was devoid of meaning, an itch of absent understanding. As it plumbed the planetary libraries in vain, Alexander slowly began to realize that this confidant had been a secret. It was singular and strangely invisible. No one on Legis 15 had ever patented or purchased anything like the device, discussed it on the news feeds, scribbled a picture of it on a work tablet, or even mentioned it in a diary entry. It was, in short, a secret of global, perhaps imperial, proportions. Alexander felt a warm rush of interest, a scintillation of energy like the fluctuations of the planet's seven private currencies when the markets opened. It knew, if only from the millions of novels and plays and games that informed its sense of drama, that when governments kept secrets, they did so at their peril. So Alexander began closer analysis of the scant data it had wrung from the confidant in those few moments it had assumed control. The machine had evidently been designed to monitor the Empress's body, a strange accessory for one of the immortal dead. Her health should have been perfect, forever. To Alexander, the confidant's recordings were noise, the data obviously encrypted with a one-time pad. The pad must exist somewhere on Legis, somewhere off the nets. The compound mind remembered its few seconds inside the confidant before the device had destroyed itself to avoid capture. For a moment, Alexander had seen the world through the machine's eyes. Starting from that slender thread, it began to reverse engineer the device, attempting to scry its purpose. Perhaps there was another hostage of sorts to take here on Legis 15. Some new lever to use against the risen empire, sworn enemy of all things Rix. Initiate. The body lay blackened and flaking on the still table, recognizable as a human only in the grossest aspect of its limbs, trunk and head. But Initiate Varan Fair stood back, wary of the charred corpse as if it were capable of sudden motion, some swift reprisal against those who had failed to protect it. Three more humans and the Rix commando lay, similarly burned, on the other tables in the room. These were the five who had been killed in the council chamber. Officially, Initiate Fair and Adept Trevum had claimed possession of their remains in case one of them were fit to rise. But clearly any such reanimation lay beyond the miracle of the symbiont. These people had been destroyed. The political's real purpose was to cut open the Child Empress's body and make sure that all evidence of the Emperor's secret was eliminated. Fair felt a strange hollow in her stomach, a void filled only with an ominous flutter, like the anxious lightness of sudden freefall. She had performed the administration of the symbiont many times, and was no stranger to dead bodies. But this palpable presence of the Emperor's secret made war against her conditioning. She wanted to blot out the sight of the Empress's fallen body, run from the room and order the building burned down. Adept Trevum had ordered Fair to steel herself, however. The initiate's medical knowledge was necessary here, and Fair was also conditioned to obey her superiors. "Which of these thaws, Fair?" Fair took a deep breath and forced her eyes to take in the array of monofilament incisors, vibrosaws, and beam cutters on the autopsy table. The tools were arranged by kind and size, the backmost raised on the stepped table like a jury, or the excavated teeth of some ancient predator displayed by form and function. Here the gnashers, here the renders, here the grinding molars. "I would stay away from beam cutters, Adept, and we haven't the skill for monofilaments." The confidant was made of nervous tissue and would be a delicate extraction. They needed to open the body in the least destructive way. "A vibrosaw, then," Trevum suggested. "Yes," Fair managed. She selected a small one and set it to its thinnest and shortest cutting width, just enough to slice through the ribcage. Fair handed it to the adept and winced at the dead woman's clumsy grip on the tool. Fair, who had been a doctor before her induction into the Emperor's service, should by rights be performing the autopsy. But the conditioning was too profound. It was all she could do to assist. Actually cutting into the corpse that housed the secret would bring forth a calamitous reaction from her internal monitors. The vibrosaw whirred to life in Trevum's hand, its whine like a mosquito caught inside one's eardrum. The sound seemed to put even the 50 years dead adept on edge as she pressed the saw against the blackened corpse. But her strokes were smooth and clean, gliding through the charred flesh like a blade through water. A mist rose up from the corpse, the faintest blur of grey in the air. Fair shuddered and reached for a medical mask. The mist looked like fine ash dust rising from a burned-out fire. Indeed, it was in every chemical sense the same fire-distilled carbon, but its source was human flesh rather than wood. Fair covered her mouth carefully, trying not to think of the small motes of dead Child Empress that would be trapped between the mask's fibers, or were settling even now into the pores of her exposed skin. The adept finished, having done almost too thorough a job. The vibrosaw had been set to undercut the connective tissues, and the Empress's rib cage lifted up easily in narrow strips as Trevum tugged. Fair leaned carefully forward, trying to quell the raging inhibitions of her conditioning. The exposed chest was almost abstract, like the plastic sculptures back in medical school, the titanic heat from the Rix blaster having burned gristle and tissue to a dark, dry mass. "And now a nerve locator?" Fair shook her head. "They only work on living subjects, or the very recently dead. You'll need a set of nervous tissue-seeking nanoprobes and a remote viewer, along with a troweling rod." She took another deep breath. "Let me show you." The adept moved aside as Initiate Fair sprayed the nanoprobes onto the glistening chest cavity. Fair let them propagate, then inserted the rod carefully, watching its readout to make sure she didn't damage the delicate strands of the confidant's skein. The troweling rod's nimble fingers, thin as piano wire, began to work the flesh, teasing the tissue from the Empress's body. But Fair had only progressed a few centimeters when she realized what she was doing, and a wave of nausea struck her. "Adept," she managed. Trevum lifted the instrument delicately from Fair's fingers as she staggered back from the still table. "That will do nicely, Initiate," she heard Trevum say. "I think I see how it works, thank you." The images stayed unshakably in her mind's eye as she sank heavily to the floor. The Emperor's sister, Child Empress Anastasia, reason for the symbiont, splayed open like a roasted pig. Vulnerable, injured, the secret exposed. And she, Varan Fair, had participated. Her stomach heaved, and acid bile rose into her throat. The taste destroyed all will, and she retched pitifully as the adept continued to remove the confidant from the fallen Empress. Captain. Lawrence Zai dropped the single-purpose remote into his pocket. It wasn't actually programmed to do anything yet. He hardly wanted to kill himself accidentally. He'd simply wanted to show Exo Hobbs the manner in which he intended to commit suicide. As a warrior, he had always borne the prospect of a messy end, but an awkward changeover of command was unacceptable. Zai felt a strange calmness as he followed Hobbs to the command bridge. The anxiety that consumed Zai during the hostage situation was gone. Over the last 2 years, love had compromised his bravery, he realized now. Hopelessness had returned it to him in good working order. Zai wondered why the Lynx had been equipped with two bridges. The warship was a new class, unlike any of the Navy's Asinonyx frigates, and a few of its design concepts had seemed odd to Zai. In addition to a battle bridge, the ship had a command bridge, as if an admiral would one day want to command a fleet from a frigate. The second bridge had wound up being used as a very well-equipped conference room. When Zai and Hobbs entered, the officers present snapped to attention. The command bridge was optimized for flat-screen viewing, the conference table folded out like a jackknife, all seats facing the high-res screen. The officers' eyes met Zai's with nervous determination, as if they had been planning a mutiny. Or plotting to save their captain's life. At ease, Zai ordered, taking the shipmaster's chair. He turned to Hobbs. Make your report, executive officer. Hobbs glanced anxiously at the hard key she'd been worrying in her hand during their discussion in the observation bubble, as if suddenly unsure that it was up to the task. Then, with a grim look, she shoved it into a slot before her. The vibration of the table's boot sequence shimmered under Zai's hand. He noted the shift of shadows in the room as overhead lights dimmed and the billions of picture elements on the wall warmed to their task. He saw his officers relax a little, as people always did when preparing to watch a canned presentation, no matter how grim the situation. Now that Zai faced death, details had become terribly clear to him. But this clarity was like amplified secondary sight, sharp, but somehow distant. The marrow of these quotidian details had been lost along with his future, as if his experiences had become suddenly worthless, like some currency decommissioned overnight. The screen showed a grainy image, its colors flattened into grayscale. The unavoidable signal loss of a helmet-sized transmitter narrowcasting all the way to low orbit. The picture seemed stretched. The pulled taffy visuals of a Marine's 360-degree vision. It took a few moments for Zai's visual cortex to adapt to the view. Like struggling to understand pre-diaspora English for the first few minutes of some ancient play. Then figure and ground sorted themselves out, and he could make out a Rick soldier, a blood-spattered admiral, an off-balance Dr. Vechner, and the body of one Empress Anastasia Vista Carmen. All were frozen, their motion suspended, the horror of the situation oddly aestheticized by the rough grain of the medium. "This is 67-21-34," Hobbs announced, her air mouse hovering in front of the timecode on the screen. Exactly 15 seconds before the stasis field was first activated by Corporal Lau. She named the participants, the air mouse flitting like a curious hummingbird from one to the next. Note that there are no visible wounds on the Empress. Blood is visible on her and the Admiral, but it spread evenly across them. It probably belongs to the Rix commandos, who had been railgunned from orbit with structure-penetrating exsanguination slugs. The air mouse shifted in response to these words, seeming to sniff the entry wound on the Rix commando. Zai had to admit that it looked like a square hit. Her guts should have been sucked out in buckets. How could she have survived? "Now, I'll advance it to the point where the stasis field interrupts transmission." The figures jolted into action, Vechner stumbling, Lau's helmet voice calling, "Come, sir," and dragging him toward the Empress. Lau deployed the field generator and her fingers reached for the controls, then the screen went black. "Now," Hobbs said, "to focus on certain elements. First, the Empress." The 15 seconds replayed on the screen with the Empress's image highlighted. She was shaking uncontrollably, having some sort of seizure. The Admiral restrained the Empress as if she were a living child thrashing her way through a nightmare. "Obviously the child Empress is alive, under some sort of stress, perhaps wounded, but alive. Now, observe the Rix woman." The scene replayed, and Zai felt himself gaining familiarity with the short document. The highlighted Rix commando was completely still. "She's dead," first pilot Maradona said to the room. "Or playing dead," Captain Zai responded.
"That's possible, sir," Hobbs allowed. "The Rick's physiology is not pulsatile, which means they don't take lungfuls of air. They filter it continuously, and their hearts spin rather than beating. So they are naturally motionless on the surface, no matter the resolution."
"Yes, sir. But allow me to skip forward to the visuals received when the situation had been secured, when Lau briefly lowered the stasis field. This is from Dr. Vechner's helmet." The screen was refreshed with a new tableau. Vechner knelt beside the Empress. The air mouse moved to indicate the Rick's soldier. She apparently hadn't moved in the interim. Hobbs left this fact unspoken.
"Note the ultrasound wrap around the Empress," Hobbs continued. "As we advance, you can see her heart beating within."
The image moved forward for 5 seconds, then the stasis field went back up and cut off the transmission again. But the heartbeat was clearly visible. The Empress had still been alive at that point.
"Damn," Zai thought. "They'd been so close."
"Why don't we have data from the ultrasound wrap?" he asked. "Shouldn't it have automatically connected with the Link's medical AI?"
"Unfortunately, the security protocols require more than 5 seconds to complete, sir. There are extensive firewalls against viruses being loaded onto the Links in the guise of emergency medical data."
Zai wondered who'd tried that little trick in the past. It sounded like typical Tongai sabotage.
"Now from Corporal Lau's perspective again," Hobbs continued. "The new Marine in the picture is Initiate Barris. His armor was crushed on Captain's orders as he had just killed another Marine with friendly fire."
Barris's motionless armor lay just outside the field area. When the image advanced, Lau reached out and dragged him inside the protective perimeter.
"Lau is moving to protect a fallen comrade," Hobbs said dryly.
Barris rolled over. His face was an appalling mess, a wreckage of tissues damaged by a bad atmospheric entry.
"Rick's here,"
Barris's twisted face said. Lau's hand darted from the field generator's controls again, and the image went dark.
"There were no Ricks in the palace at that point," Hobbs said firmly. "Nor had Barris seen any Ricks at all. For some reason, he lied."
Zai shook his head. "He'd just had a firefight with another Marine, whom he must have thought was Ricks. Initiate Barris wasn't lying, just unbelievably stupid."
"Can we see Barris's visuals?" someone asked. "From when he killed the Marine?"
"I'm afraid his helmet transmitter was trashed on entry, but we do have that event from the other side." New visuals loaded onto the screen. The administrative text identified the viewpoint as Private Ernesto. From a kneeling position, he held a position in front of the council chamber's door, facing out into the palace's broad hallways. The black hemisphere of the stasis field could be seen in Ernesto's rearmost vision. Initiate Barris, recognizable from his smashed helmet, staggered into view. Ernesto waved at him, but Barris raised his weapon. The initiate's verigun fired, and Ernesto's viewpoint spun as he was knocked back by a hail of small projectiles. The barrage went on, the damage to suit and soldier recorded in grim little glyphs along the bottom of the screen. A second before Ernesto must have died, the armor lost its ability to transmit and the screen froze.
"Not much fog of war there," Maradona commented. "Barris would have to override the friendly fire governor," the Marine sergeant added.
Zai wondered if these observations had been scripted in advance. What were his senior staff suggesting anyway? That the initiate had gone in purposefully to kill Ernesto? Or the Empress, for that matter? That was unthinkable. Politicals were bound by governors far more insurmountable than some fail-safe on a barragun. Their minds were fixed to a state of selfless loyalty by years of painful conditioning. On some grey planets, they were selected from birth for genes that showed high susceptibility to brainwashing. They were beyond suspicion.
"The fog was in Barris's mind," Zai said. "He'd suffered a grievous head injury on entry. He probably thought every suit of armor he saw was Rick's."
"Exactly, sir," Hobbs agreed. "Rick's here. His last recorded words."
The screen split into three parts. In the first two frames, the Rick soldier lay in her now familiar position, looking dead as ever. But in the last frame, her body was a blackened husk, even the marble floor beneath her scorched by the blaster shot that had killed everyone inside the stasis field. It was evident now from the trio of images. All three positions were much the same. Although the commando's body had been jostled by the blast, there was no sense that she had sprung back to life and raised her weapon. Indeed, in the last frame, the ruined Rick's blaster lay across her left ankle, much closer to the burned hands of Barris than her own. "Where is the initiate's weapon?" someone asked. Hobbs's response was instantaneous. These questions must be scripted, Zai thought with growing annoyance. The screen again showed the last recording from Lau's viewpoint. As she dragged Fair's body into the stasis field's perimeter, his Varigun stayed outside. He had dropped it when the Lynx had crashed his armor. A murmur came from the assembled officers. "He had no weapon," Hobbs said, "but the Rick's blast was already within."
"Hobbs,"
Captain Zai snapped. The anger in his voice shocked the room into silence. The officers sat as motionless as the image from doomed Mirami Lau's helmet.
"Thank you all for this briefing," Zai said. "Executive officer, in my observation blister, now."
He stood and wheeled away from the surprised faces and strode from the command bridge. He was gone so fast that it took a few moments for Kathry Hobbs to catch up in the corridors outside. Zai and his executive officer walked in silence back toward the plastic bubble that faced the void. Commando. The commando's heart, if you could call it that, was closer to a turbine than a pump. A pair of long screws, one venous and the other arterial, rotated inside her chest, threading the vital fluid through her body at an inhumanly fast and even rate. The liquid carried oxygen and nutrients, but was not, properly speaking, blood. It also served the purposes of a lymphatic system, transporting uptake nanos from thousands of tiny lymph nodes distributed along her arteries. The substance in the commando's veins had little else to do with her Rick's immune system, however. It contained no white blood cells, whose functions had been delegated centuries before to a scattered population of organs roughly the size of rice grains, themselves generated by small machines hidden in the marrow of her bird-light, aircraft-strong, hypercarbon bones. The surging fluid did, however, contain enough iron to oxidize red when it was spilled, a situation that the commando was currently attempting to avoid. She was tucked into an area smaller than an overnight bag, a space that normally housed a cleaning robot. The Rickswoman had disassembled the previous occupant, hoping the scattered parts would not reveal her appropriation of its home, and folded herself into the space, limbs bending at sharp angles like some origami construction. According to the messages sent to her from Alexander, her invisible and omnipresent benefactor in this chase, the local militia were searching for her with sonic sweeps. These devices were designed to find escaped fugitives by detecting that steady, unstoppable, telltale rhythm of humanity, the heartbeat. Apparently, no one had told the locals that she, a Rick's commando, had none. The tiny turbine purred inside her chest, an infrasonic hiss without rhythm or vibrato, and the nervous, soft-chewed sweep operators passed by her hiding place, blissfully unaware. The commando, who was called Herd, had gone to ground in a building that was called, in the local language, a library. This structure served as a distribution point for proprietary data, information not available in the public infrastructure. Corporate secrets, technological patents, personal medical records, and certain erotic poems and images available by paid subscription were deposited here, accessible only to those with special physical keys, totems of information ownership. Alexander had guided Herd here, helping the commando fight and creep her way across 100 kilometers of dense city that swarmed with militia, police, and the occasional Imperial Marine, all searching for her. But Alexander was a powerful ally, and even a single Rick's commando was deadly quarry. The local forces made a show of the pursuit, evacuating buildings, running sweeps, and occasionally firing their weapons, but were more interested in self-preservation than glory, and the Imperial Marines numbered fewer than 100. The commando waited in the library with inhuman patience. For 7 hours she lay folded in her compartment. It was strange here in the darkness, so alone. Herd had spent her entire life in the intimate company of her drop sisters, never separated from the sibling group for more than a few minutes. The 15 commandos in her dropship had been raised together, trained together into a perfect fighting unit, and were supposed to have died together. The commando felt no grief, an unknown emotion in her warrior caste. But she did mourn her lost sisters.
Surviving this suicide mission alone had left her in limbo, ranging this hostile planet like the